If an oxygen hose kinks at 25,000 feet, will you be ready? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And we're here to talk safety issues as we do on Mondays generally. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Well, Paul, I enjoy being with you.
In the February issue of Over the Airwaves, you related an accident that happened based on what sounds like plain old failure of an oxygen system. Tell us about that story and what we can learn from it.
Well, this was a very sad, as all fatal accidents are. An individual went up in a Cirrus SR-22 and using, you know, an installed oxygen system in the aircraft. And then at 25,000 feet, the airplane went silent, so to speak, from a radio communications perspective with ATC. And it was later determined that the NTSB report concluded that there was an oxygen problem on board the aircraft. And he had been using a device that I'd been using for a number of years in my 210. It's an oxygen regulator. It's made by a company called Mountain High. It's a wonderful little device that operates very similar to a scuba regulator in that it pulses oxygen just with each inhaled breath rather than just allowing it to free flow into a cannula or a mask. The NTSB, unfortunately, took issue with the fact that the use of this equipment altered the installed system, which was done without any kind of supplemental type certificate or approval from the FAA, and they pretty strongly inferred that that was the cause of the problem. The point I was making in the article was in those upper flight levels, certainly above 22,000 to 23,000 feet, there is just very little room for time or error, I should say, in an oxygen system. And that was the point of the article.
Now, one thing I found interesting about this, this is one of those things you read about that if they had live video going on, the entire country would have been watching this plane flying with an unconscious pilot on autopilot. The oxygen tank was at 29% capacity at the time of the accident, which suggests that without the regulator, it might not have held enough oxygen for the flight. Now, I don't know how much oxygen, honestly, these things hold. Is that something that might have been a situation where he used the regulator because he was using it to extend his range?
Well, you use the regulator, it does extend the range. You use up half as much oxygen. Back that after an extra hour flight, they still found 29% contents left, percent of the oxygen left, is if he wasn't inhaling, then the tank wasn't dispensing. So it was the regulator that, in fact, had to be in the system. Otherwise, the tank itself, in another hour like that, free-flowing, it could very likely have been exhausted. But then again, it's hard to say. You know, a 90 cubic foot tank is going to hold for one person probably 10 hours worth of oxygen, again, depending on how the flow is set. So, you know, that it's a curious finding that they might be blaming the Mountain High unit. I want to go on record and saying that's a wonderful unit. I think we all should have them. But whenever I've operated above 23,000 feet, there again is just very little time. Your time of useful consciousness above 24,000 feet is measured in just minutes. Remarkably improved, however, down around 17,000 to 18,000 feet, well over 30 minutes. So if something is going wrong at the 18,000, 17,000 feet, it's not nearly as critical as if something goes wrong in the oxygen system at 24,000, 25,000 feet.
Okay, now, the Mountain High unit, you mentioned that it wasn't part of the certificated oxygen system on the airplane. In theory, it probably didn't need to be.
Well, yes, it's not a permanently installed system, so it comes under the classification of any kind of a portable device. But as I recall in the article, Cirrus had a specific prohibition in their pilot's operating handbook that said no alteration of our oxygen system is permissible under any circumstance. And in Mountain High's defense, they were very clear in their promotional material saying that they don't have a type STC either for its use. This is strictly at the pilot's discretion to use this. Now, in order to use it in any system, you have to break the line, if you will, between the outflow valve and the aircraft and insert that line into the mountain high unit and then take your line that you're breathing from that comes out of the mountain high unit. So this is actually cuts into one of the tubes, the oxygen tubes that's permanently equipped with the airplane. So there is an alteration of the system in order to make it usable.
All right. Now, obviously, you've made the decision that this is a valuable device to have. What should this guy maybe have done differently?
Well, there was no mention, I don't believe, I don't think in the NTSB report there was any mention, but I will not use it without a portable pulse oximeter. A portable pulse oximeter can be purchased today for around $200. You insert your finger in it, and it's like a little cup on the end of your finger, and it will give you a digital readout as to what your blood oxygen content is. And I know that we need to be around 90% blood oxygen concentration up at high altitude. If I don't have the thing turned on full enough, my blood oxygen concentration will drop down to 85, maybe 83, and it's at that point that I turn the system up. If the system, for some reason, doesn't turn up, then I have no choice but to descend rather quickly. I also carry along another device produced by Mountain High, and that's it looks like a very large CO2 container cartridge with a little valve on the end of it, and that contains oxygen as well. So if I should suffer an interruption in the aircraft system, I can reach down and grab this CO2 type bottle and start using that. I've never had to do it, but it sits there right between the seats. So again, at 25,000 feet, you've got to have a solid backup just in case there's any interruption in that flow of oxygen at that altitude.
When we return, was the autopilot friend or foe here? More with Bob Miller in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Freedom through control. Cirrus has completely reinvented the personal aircraft and the entire experience of owning a personal aircraft. It's a bold new take on private aviation that we call Cirrus Flying 2.0. You set the schedule. You chart the course. You're in control.
Piperjet.
Piper Match.
Global Expansion.
Meridian, Mirage, Matrix, and more.
With so much happening at Piper, how can I possibly keep up?
Get informed. Get involved at facebook.com/Piper Aircraft.
Welcome back to the Aero News Special Feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking with Bob Miller about an accident in which a pilot apparently lost oxygen, then consciousness at high altitude, and never recovered. Bob, what about the contribution of the autopilot in this scenario? Obviously, this is really hypothetical since few people fly IFR manually. But if this airplane was being flown manually and was in trim, when the engine quit, it should have entered a descent on its own, and the guy might have had a chance once the air got thicker.
If he wasn't, unfortunately, dead already, and in this accident, I could only surmise that he had expired. He was no longer living, and the airplane was still flying. It was like the Payne Stewart tragedy several years back, and it was a pressurization problem in the aircraft. The airplane wasn't pressurizing, and then they suffered hypoxia, and the crew and passengers went unconscious, likely died before the airplane ever hit the ground. So whether or not the autopilot kept it up there any longer, I don't know. There's an obvious risk to people on the ground, of course, with something like this. And I believe from the report that the National Guard dispatched a couple of F-18s up there to see where this airplane was going to wind up going. And I guess they concluded that it was going to come down in a non-populated area, so didn't turn out to be a major problem in that regard.
Well, I wasn't talking so much about the autopilot keeping it up there as the autopilot having been responsible for it entering a stall and spin.
Well, that's right. It would take an autopilot or a pilot to make an airplane spin. An airplane cannot spin all by itself. It will just because it can't hold that high angle of attack unless there's some artificial means to do that. Sure. If the autopilot wasn't on and the pilot passed out and the airplane came down immediately, because let's say the airplane just started descending down for some reason, if the pilot is, you know, his lucky stars were working that particular day, or there was an angel on his wing, he may have come to and regained control of the airplane before it hit the ground. If that's what you're thinking, yeah, that possibly could have happened.
All right. Let's talk about training for this, because I remember going through private pilot training. Obviously, if you're flying in the flight levels up there, you're probably on an instrument flight plan. I remember training about hypoxia and very, very minor touching on aircraft systems to do with oxygen, but nothing in depth enough to give me the kind of experience or judgment or knowledge I'd need to deal with a decision like this guy was making. Where does that come from, and should there be additional training available, and is there?
Paul, I'm chuckling because this is a subject of some other discussions we've had about what should be regulatorily required. There is no high altitude endorsement required to operate at altitudes. There is for a high performance airplane, complex airplane, but there's no other requirement. And so I think what you're suggesting is certainly very useful. Any pilot that plans to operate up there in those higher altitudes should receive some sort of training. Where that training is available, I do not know. We give it high altitude training in our flight school, but we're fortunate enough to have a turbocharged airplane available to us to do that. I think most of us, and I for one, learned it the hard way. We just went up there and fooled around with the oxygen until we were convinced that we had this under control. And all of us that are alive today, it worked. There have been some notable accidents that have resulted from high altitude flight where pilots, in fact, have passed out. Now, you know, the Air Force, the military requires high altitude or an altitude chamber training prior to their permitting of military crews to fly at that level. But at the civilian level, I'm not aware of any such training.
So should this be a separate high altitude endorsement, or should it be part of the instrument curriculum?
Well, to operate above 18,000 feet, you have to be on an instrument flight plan. What percentage of the instrument pilots operate at 18,000 feet in the general aviation world, I think, is a very, very small percentage. So to put it in the instrument curriculum may be a bit of an overkill. There's so many more things that I think would be more useful in that curriculum if we were to enrich in it other than this. But I certainly think that any manufacturer, I would suspect that COPA, the Cirrus Owners and Pilots Association, has a high altitude program. I suspect Bonanza, American Bonanza Society, can certainly point their students or their customers to one as well. But there's not many out there that I'm aware of that have set up on any kind of a formal basis.
If it does become a regulation, we know from, again, from recent discussions that that's probably a 10-year process if somebody really wants to do it. Would this be the kind of thing that would really make a difference? Or would this be one of those things where we read in NTSB accident reports after the fact that he did not have one?
I think any training is good, Paul. And I think any mandated training is even better. The FAA requires mandated training to do precision radar monitoring approaches, close parallel approaches. It requires at least the completion of a video training that they put on their site. They also require the FAA a video training before you can come into the special flight rules areas that exist in Washington, D.C.'s and other areas. So they make that mandated training, and it's very easy to get. It's a 20-minute, 28-minute video you watch online. There has been no such training, to my knowledge, for high-altitude flight. So whether or not we make it mandated or not, this is something that perhaps we should look at this to say, you know, pilots are going to be operating up there in non-pressure, even pressurized airplanes should have some sort of backup plan in mind in the event their primary systems fail. They certainly should know what resources they have available to them.
Well, Bob, as always, food for thought. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can sign up to receive Bob Miller's monthly e-newsletter and be automatically sent the current issue at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.